Good morning. This is Eric Clay with the Made of Clay Report, and we are in the second hour, and our guest for this hour is Bob Ritter, and I will get that pronunciation correct. This is one of my challenges in life, is getting names right, of remembering them and pronouncing them right, and I do, and I value being corrected, and thank you.
Sure.
Bob, it's good to have you here today.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And in the community, we know Bob as the executive director of the Cancer Resource Center of the Finger Lakes, and you have a weekly newspaper column, and you're present in the community in many, many different ways. But the point of my show, The Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues of our lives, is to get to know the people who, in some more informal ways, who are part of our community. And as yourself, you're a highly public figure, but I've also had people who are cleaning rooms in the Statler Hotel. You know, part-time staff at Cornell. I've had a whole host of different people, mm-hmm. but it's our way to kind of get to know each other a little bit better.
Okay.
And in that spirit, tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, give me a sketch, a mosaic, a picture. Who are you?
It's a good question, and I'm really kind of a bit of an amalgam. I'm from Appalachia.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in West Virginia. I have a Russian Jewish background, so Russian Jewish Appalachian don't always go together.
Right, but they may not be as far apart as some of us might assume, especially if you're Russian Shtetl Jewish in Appalachia.
That's true. That's true. That's true. A big focus of my life has been healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
That earlier in my career, I focused very much on the elderly. I was into geriatrics and worked in hospitals, nursing homes. As you mentioned, for the last 16 years, I've been very focused on issues relating to cancer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And certainly when I was growing up, I didn't expect to become a cancer guy.
Right. So how did that happen?
Well, it happened because I was diagnosed with breast cancer, mm-hmm. out of the blue.
One of those significant minority of men who get breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 1% of breast cancer occurs in men. And when I was diagnosed, I was 40 years old, had no family history of breast cancer. And, I found a lump, and then I had some bleeding from my nipple. And I was talking to the surgeon, and we did a biopsy, and then I was scheduled for a mastectomy, and it all just seemed very, very surreal.
Right.
To write down mastectomy on my date book. But that sort of thrust me into the cancer world.
So you changed your profession to follow your personal experience.
I did. Not completely, because. Mm-hmm. I was in healthcare administration.
Right.
I was teaching healthcare, and what I do now is really a combination of what I've done in the past. Mm-hmm. I do lots of teaching. I do lots of writing. I do, I administer a small nonprofit agency.
Mm-hmm.
So I really get to wear lots of different hats that I've always worn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you come to Ithaca?
I came here in 1994.
So it's been
19 years,
mm-hmm.
and I came here originally to teach at Ithaca College.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching health administration, health policy, and gerontology. And that brought me here. And actually, when I remember first driving into town on Route 13 coming through Newfield, and
right.
I just remembered the topology of the place looked very similar to my hometown.
I was going to say, yeah, there are parts of West Virginia that they're a little bouncier sometimes.
Uh-huh.
They're a little more jagged hills, but
right.
Yeah.
And actually, Ithaca is the northern edge of Appalachia.
Yep. Tioga County, all the counties, the legal definition of Appalachia from the government's point of view is just south of here. We're on the edge.
Right,
we're
very
on the
much,
edge.
Very
yeah,
much.
Yeah. Yep. So what keeps you here?
I really feel comfortable here. It just feels like home. And I just realized just recently, I've now lived here longer than I lived any place else.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in West Virginia, went to college in Ohio, Oberlin, Ohio, and University of Michigan, and I've lived in Columbus, Ohio, and Wheeling, West Virginia. But somehow, Ithaca just seemed like home,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and just a very natural, almost kind of an unconscious settling in.
Mm-hmm. And what made it different than those other places for you?
I think Ithaca is very open to who you are, and I didn't feel like I had to, you know, fit into anyone's preconceived expectations. I like the academic feel of the town. Mm-hmm. I liked that people are curious. I like the energy.
Mm-hmm.
I like the optimism generally.
Right, and you came into town as things were turning a tad more optimistic, because I think back in the 70s and 80s there was some real hard fought, you know, lots of negativity, and people began to say, we got to live a little different here, because
uh-huh.
Public meetings could be shouting matches in the 80s and early 90s, and
mm-hmm.
and we've grown up, I think,
as a
community in that respect.
Yeah, and certainly since I've been here, I've seen some of the shouting matches. Which it's always kind of a mixed blessing, because in some ways I see some people who talk first and think second,
or they talk with their mouth open like I have them to do sometimes.
Sure, but I like it when people are passionate about things. I like it mm-hmm. when they're involved and they speak their minds and they're you know, they want to be aware and make other people aware of their own opinions.
And your work in the cancer with the Cancer Resource Center puts you in touch with people when they have they may be shut down emotionally, but they have very strong feelings.
Sure, but I don't necessarily think that people are shut down emotionally. I think
they can be in shock initially, and then they come out of it.
Shock. I mean, at first people are a little bit stunned.
Yeah.
But I find that people are pretty much who they are, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. cancer doesn't change that.
Right. What needs attention here in Ithaca Tompkins County from your point of view? What do we need to be looking at and addressing?
Uh-huh. Well, you know, my focus is really health and cancer. That's sort
mm-hmm,
of
mm-hmm.
the lens which I see things. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that we do a remarkably good job here compared to most places. And I think, you know, it's 20 years ago, people didn't talk about cancer. I mean, it was a scary thing, mm-hmm. and people didn't discuss it. And we're much better about that now, but we still have to get better about it.
Right, and I have that's something that I hear and I wince at, because I've been dealing with cancer as a chaplain and in hospital settings and with family members for mm-hmm. 30, 40 years, and it's been a big part of my life. So I forget sometimes that in it's been a much more recent conversation for many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know people who hesitate to come through the front door of the Cancer Resource Center, because if they come through, it's acknowledging that they have cancer, and cancer is just too scary.
They or their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you see as the kind of the next set of... We're doing well. But what do you see as kind of the next set of concerns in being a caring community?
Mm-hmm. You know, what I'm seeing more and more is that lots of people go through cancer, and we have lots of focus on their initial diagnosis, on their treatment. What we're realizing more and more is that there are thousands of people who have gone through cancer and are now at the other end,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't done enough for them. You know, if you've been through cancer, people always wonder, will it come back?
Right.
People wonder, well, what can I do to reduce my risk of a recurrence?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the whole notion of survivorship is relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
But here in Tompkins County, we have roughly 3,000 people who've had cancer.
Right.
Which is a lot of people.
Right. I mean, 3% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And with varying lengths of survivorship, mm-hmm. or whatever the proper word is.
Sure.
So what is it that you see? What is it that these people want once they've been, like yourself, once you've been a long-term survivor? What is it that you need?
I think people want to know what they can do. people want to be proactive, mm-hmm. and they want to know what they can do in terms of diet, health, exercise. Mm-hmm. They want to reduce their risk of recurrence. Mm-hmm. But what's also probably the hardest thing about cancer is dealing with uncertainty.
Right.
And everyone has to deal with it because oftentimes, you know, we don't know what the cause is. We don't know, you know, if the treatment will be successful. We don't know if you'll have a recurrence. We can always talk in generalities, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but we don't know what will happen to you specifically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And sometimes people, you know, will ask their oncologist, you know, will this treatment cure me? And usually the response is, we don't know.
We can tell you 5-year statistics at best,
mm-hmm.
but not much more than that.
Right.
I've had several friends who've had recurrences of breast cancer or, you know, on the other side or whatever, or other cancers. And when people want to know about diet and exercise and the things that they can do, and then you're saying that there's this shroud of uncertainty, how do you respond to those requests?
What I do is try to provide the information the best way that I can, but then kind of reassure people that there is uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people look for the magic answer, and sometimes they just have to be told there is no magic answer.
Right, and you're moving from what would be historically kind of the delivery of a product or a service to lots of science-based stuff where you're getting out beyond probabilities to unknowns and ambiguities and things.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting more into the realm of spirituality and religion,
mm-hmm.
in these survivor issues. And how do you connect with that community, or how do you connect with those sets of issues?
Oh, sure. I think it's, you know, in dealing with uncertainty, sometimes what makes it better is to have faith. Whether to have faith in a spiritual faith or simply mm-hmm. having faith in your positions.
Mm-hmm.
And when people have that sort of faith, they often relax a little bit.
And what do you mean by the term faith?
Faith is, I think it's very individual to the person. It's this kind of inherent trust that things will be okay or things will work out for the best.
Mm-hmm.
You have faith, you have this belief that your physician is working with you to the best of his or her ability,
mm-hmm.
and everything is on your side.
Right, right, and I think what's individualistic about it may be more how each person experiences it, but traditionally the definition of faith has been an attitude of trust and hope. And another way of framing that is realistic optimism,
mm-hmm.
is to see clearly as you can, even with all the ambiguity and uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
and maintain an attitude that I will and others with me will do the best we can. We may not change the outcome,
mm-hmm.
but we will. Being optimistic means that I'm open-eyed and open-hearted to what's happening,
mm-hmm.
even when it's not a positive thing. But if I close down, I can't even hear what's possible.
Right.
And so I think you're into some really important issues, and if you can get people to kind of frame them in those sorts of ways. It's hard, though. It's really
it is.
Hard.
Yeah, and oftentimes with cancer, you know, sometimes you don't necessarily hope for a cure, because sometimes a cure is not possible.
It's not real.
Yeah, but you can hope for a good life, good quality of life. You can hope for, you know, whatever you have.
Or you can change what your attitude is about quality, because what you would have required as a younger person or in a different time of your life isn't what you need now, and it's not what's possible, but there's still something good.
Right.
And that's a discovery process that no one can navigate that water for you. You kind of have to do it yourself.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So I ask all the guests to come with a playlist, and I'd like to know, what would you like for us to listen to as a song that you found? Did you enjoy? That's a good piece of your life.
Well, here's of course a classic by by Stevie Wonder for once in my life.
Okay, we're gonna get this playing.
Me, I'm not alone anymore. Oh, once I can sing, this is mine. You can't take it. Long as I know I have love, I can make it. For once in my life, I have someone who needs me. Oh, for once in my life, somebody that needs me.
And that was Stevie Wonder for Once in My Life. I have someone who needs me. And, I want to just stay with that notion. And one of the things about faith is we kind of learn to rely to this attitude of trust and hope, mm-hmm. Realistic optimism. We have to learn to rely on ourselves differently and engage others in a slightly different way. Sometimes to kind of keep centered in that realism and that optimism. What do you want to say about your own experience of this being a survivor and what you're encouraging other people to think about as they explore mm-hmm. what this faith is about?
Sure. Well, I remember after I was diagnosed, I spent more time looking in the library at different books about faith and kind of exploring different faith traditions. And I always enjoyed that. And it always struck me that so many different faiths were looking at the same thing through different lenses. Mm-hmm. And the more time I spent with it, the more I thought that the journey was the interesting part to explore. And I found that I liked people who explored, who thought about faith more so than, I mean, what they believed. I mean, what their actual dogma or whatever was. I liked people who thought about it. And I just seemed like there's no single answer.
Right. I mean, when you say that, what I'm hearing is you like people who have struggled with a question that's bigger than what they can answer.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
And even our dogmatic answers are no answers at all when we push them hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a person who has been through the mill from the Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, any perspective. There are dogmatic answers. But when you push them hard, you have to make them your own, and that's the process that I would call faith as opposed to religion, is where you own that struggle. And so you're saying that people who are able to talk about that struggle and reflect on it with you are the ones where you found the greatest connection.
Mm-hmm. I do. I like it when people can sort of ponder and struggle and realize there are no exact answers. And you know, it really does parallel to cancer in that a lot of times we don't have exact answers. You know, we don't know for sure, but there's no single right path to approach cancer.
Right, and I guess what I want to shift the emphasis, because what you value isn't in the answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's in what I would call the longing.
Mm-hmm.
And where people need to kind of practice is understanding what is the nature of what you long for. Do you long for, you know, a perfect body or perfect health? You know, you're not going to have that. I mean, that's not going to happen for any of us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you long for something that is satisfying but more nuanced? And can you accept many, many different things that might happen? How do you come to terms with just saying what is about yourself in a way that's open and flexible enough that you can then discover what's possible? Mm-hmm. I mean, faith is this process of discovering a life worth living and then striving to live it.
Mm-hmm. True. And, you know, in a sense, you know, I figured out that my, you know, personally, I realize I can't save the world, but what I try to do is help my neighbor, and
right. That's
sort of what I do. And you know, as I've gotten older and hopefully wiser, my focus has shifted a little bit to more and more kind of a narrow focus. I don't want to do huge things, but I can always do something to make life better for the people around me.
For specific people
right. Around
you, not the people in general around you, but the specific people around
right. You.
And that is, that's a sign of maturity, and not trying to fix the abstract, which is always going to be somewhat elusive and only really present in a very specific person or a very specific practice in front of our faces.
Right, and I'd much rather try to fix one small thing than complain about 20 things.
Right. And I'm gonna push you a little bit, because when you say fix, I can hear some people saying we're just gonna solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it can also mean we're just gonna find out what it is we can do with that problem to live with it a little differently, or to make it go away, or a fix as in healing. You know, healing isn't always a cure.
Right.
You know, healing is no longer having angst over the issue and knowing you're going to die with it, but dying with peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so all of those kinds of things, I think you mean that by fix in a lot of different ways.
Oh, very much. And oftentimes the best thing that I can do for people come through our doors will be listen to them.
Yeah.
And that's not really fixing the cancer per se, but it's what that person needs at that point in time.
You become what they cannot be for themselves, which is they have to speak. Somebody has to listen, and especially when the family, if the family or the friend, or if there is no family or friend, but the family's conflicted, or they can't hear, or they can't speak honestly to somebody because they have to couch, then they will never be heard.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can give them the space to speak with their honest voice,
mm-hmm.
then that's a gift.
Oh, very much.
An enormous gift.
Sure. And sometimes the role of the chaplain is to simply be with people when they're in dark places.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's a function that you play too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah.
And part of my job almost is pastoring, and that's probably the part that I enjoy the most.
Right. And I think one of the things that strikes me about just looking at the website of the Cancer Resource Center of the Finger Lakes is that all of your staff names and addresses are your first names at crfl.net.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of a personal quality. In a lot of professional healthcare organizations or professional life or workplace things, that kind of personal quality is not what we lead with anymore, because we're about privacy, we're about all this, you know, protecting data, we're about keeping each other separate and creating this space, which is, but it's what matters is self-determination in a crisis. And by positioning yourself with your personal names and your persons out front, you can encourage people to be self-determining and not get stuck in this overly professionalized atmosphere that we sometimes get stuck in.
Right. And in fact, we bend over backwards to be personalized and to be warm, to be carried, and not to have the kind of clinical mindset. That's not who we are. That's not what our people need.
To respect boundaries, but more important than privacy is self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important lesson for this community, because we are affluent enough that we often want things to be more private than is helpful.
True.
So to come to this kind of a reflective turn in your life, I haven't known many people who can speak of faith in the way that you have and that we've discussed and played around with definitions, who haven't been forced to change some kind of a deeply held commitment. They've had to kind of come to terms with their own changing course in a profound way in order to learn the skills of reinvention and resilience is really what we're talking about here.
Right.
So what have you learned that forced you to change deeply?
You know, I think at one point in time, certainly growing up and through college and early career, I thought if you were smart enough and worked hard enough, you could do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
That it was just a matter of being tenacious and just working your butt off.
Yeah. Shoulder, nose to the grindstone, shoulder to the wheel, just push.
Yeah. But, you know, through cancer, I realized, you know, no matter how smart you are or how hard you work, there's some things that are just out of your control.
And how has that changed you?
Well, one, it made me realize a fair amount of life is about luck. You know, people who have, you know, good jobs, good insurance, all those things, it's partly due to hard work, but it's partly luck too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people get diseases early in life, and it's not because they didn't work hard enough. It's just sometimes it's luck of the draw.
Right.
So that really kind of made me aware, you know, not to judge people. You know, there are lots of people with all kinds of illnesses, physical illnesses, mental illnesses, that they have no control over. And it's not a matter of thinking hard enough or working hard enough. Sometimes it just is.
Right. You can't avoid it, but you can find a way to live with it.
Right. And then the issue becomes, well, now that it is, how do you live with it the best you can?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And some people, the best is too high a standard. I mean, just how do you survive until you find your feet?
Mm-hmm.
Different things knock people off their feet, more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no knowing why.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a matter of just trying to keep, you know, the feet going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So was this through your own experience of cancer that you realized this, or how did you become aware?
Yeah, it's really mostly through my own experience, just realizing that things happen, and how much we cannot control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, it's both scary and also freeing.
Right, and it's, but when you say we can't control, you also mean we can't know.
Mm-hmm.
We can neither know nor control what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
That puts us in a very different relationship.
Mm-hmm.
When you see people beginning to cycle through that sense of being out of control, and the healthcare is and what they don't know what they can do, what they want to do, they know that they're not in control of their bodies or their lives. How do you be with them? What is
that? I think it's really a matter of, as you say, being with them. Sometimes what I do is really focus on the person. Sometimes they get overwhelmed with input from loved ones, sometimes their healthcare team, and they're dealing with lots of input. And I try to step back and ask, well, what do you want? Mm-hmm. And what lets you sleep better at night? And sometimes people, particularly with cancer, people get inundated with advice that you should go here for treatment, you should do this alternative treatment, you should do this, you should do that. And usually this advice is well-intentioned, but it's usually not helpful.
In this kind of moment of reflection, of kind of this crisis moment when our conversation is talking about, is there one of your songs that we can play that would speak to that?
Sure. It's actually a wonderful tune by Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway called Come Ye Disconsolate.
Yeah.
last line about something that heaven cannot cure. And like you, like we'd said before, it's not necessarily about the cure as much as it is about the healing. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues is when you've been hit with a cancer diagnosis, or when you've learned that you can't continue living the way you've lived in the past, you got to find something new and reinvent those core commitments. I mean, some people will just soldier on through as though nothing changed, but for many it means kind of taking a stock in a new mm-hmm. way and perhaps finding some new goals. How have you traveled through that process?
Well, personally, the cancer changed me in that it changed my, well, one, it changed my time horizon, because I used to think very long into the future. You know, what am I doing 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? And after the cancer, I became much more focused on today. You know, what am I doing now? What am I doing tomorrow? Am I making a contribution in some way that I feel comfortable with? Mm-hmm. And that really kind of, of course, changed my career. But I talk to people all the time who come in with a cancer diagnosis who are wondering, you know, how it will change them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In lots of ways, cancer does not change them.
I mean, they become more of who they are.
Exactly. And in some ways, I think cancer is like life on steroids. It's the same thing, but everything is
intensified. Everything more so.
Yeah, it makes, you know, good families better. It makes difficult families more difficult. It makes grumpy people grumpier.
Right, right. I want to go back to an image that you just used, which is can be helpful, I think, in people who are struggling. When we live into a future that we want to be, we spend more of our time in that future space or in that future state than we do in the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of cancer oftentimes forces us to change what the picture is, but it also changes what our relationship is to the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So we never lose that picture that's out there, either in the future or the bigger picture around us, but we see more, what am I doing today that contributes to that, or that perhaps lives to a different future than mm-hmm. the one I had thought I was going to have?
Mm-hmm.
That tension between the bigger or the further down the road and the right now, right in front of my face, is the beautiful tension to mm-hmm. live with.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear you talking, the balance of power shifted from the big picture, the future picture, to the immediate step.
Mm-hmm.
And how does it fit in? Or am I taking a step I never would have imagined, and does that imply there's a bigger picture that I never thought of?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but certainly you're right that the balance shifted to the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
I clearly learned that nothing is guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the trickier balances with cancer is living day by day, doing the best you can, going towards the future, but also realizing in a very real sense that the future is not guaranteed.
Right, right. And but you can still face it with optimism into the unknown
mm-hmm.
without a guarantee, but that is a tricky path.
It is.
And that's the fruit of a lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times people with cancer talk almost about a line of demarcation,
mm-hmm.
you know, life before cancer and life after cancer.
Right.
But when you're, you know, 4 years post-cancer, it's very different than 1 year post-cancer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a real evolution that, you know, the first year after I was diagnosed, you know, cancer was in the middle of my brain all the time when I went to sleep and when I woke up.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, it fades.
Right, right. And it may, if your coping has become more realistic, it fades, but you don't have to assume any more certainty about the future.
Mm-hmm.
But if it fades and you go back to habits of certainty about the future, then it can come shockingly back into your life,
mm-hmm.
which I think may be part of what's behind needing to reach out to survivors who are facing things. They're being hit again in ways that they didn't
sure.
know they were going to have to be prepared for.
Sure. And I think the people who deal with it most successfully are people who acknowledge the cancer and deal with the cancer, but don't let the cancer overwhelm them. They
right,
keep moving
right.
forward.
My life walk includes a partner that is cancer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not about, it's not cancer, but it includes a part of me that is about cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So you must see many, many different sorts of people who come through your facility, your program, your activities, people that you want to keep in focus as people and not cases or statistics. How do you work with others who are not like you and whose values may differ diametrically from yours?
Mm-hmm.
How do you work with them with integrity?
It's always a challenge, but it's probably the most important thing that I do in some ways. I mean, for example, just to give some examples, I know some people who get very, very aggressive treatment, although the probability that treatment being helpful is almost zero,
mm-hmm.
that they'll, you know, I want to say, well, you should really focus on the quality of your life and not try to mm-hmm. extend your life for one more month. But some people say, I want to do everything possible to live even one more day.
I had one professor who said, you know, for me, I'm going to go kicking and screaming because for me, the quality is the fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good example.
Right.
So I have, you know, some people I disagree with that way. I see other people who are diagnosed with a cancer who say they don't want...
It's all over.
What they say is that they don't want chemotherapy, surgery, or radiation. They want to do only alternative stuff.
Uh-huh.
And
we have a strong alternative medicine program here in Ithaca.
We do. And I'm very supportive of alternative medicine, essentially complementary medicine. Mm-hmm, when mm-hmm. you use acupuncture, massage therapy, nutrition as an adjunct to conventional treatment,
mm-hmm.
I get concerned when people say, I'm not doing conventional treatment, I'll do alternative stuff first. And, you know, in some cases, treatment is fairly straightforward, very established, very effective, and I see people not do that
mm-hmm.
and get alternative treatment when I think that's a bad choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly be a bad choice for me. But people have to choose their own path.
Right. And live with those consequences and process what the next step will be when something happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes what I do with that is simply provide some context and say, you know, that's, you know, if you pursue that path, you'll be at the extreme 0.5% to do that
mm-hmm.
versus, you know, the more, you know, 99% of people would do this approach.
Mm-hmm.
And
it would have this percentage benefit, likely.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And I just try to, I like to help people make informed choices, but it's very much their choice. It's their body, and I support them. Also, I think in some cases it makes sense to do no treatment. I think it's a very valid thing to say, you know, there's no evidence that chemotherapy or whatever is going to do me much good, so I will just opt to do nothing right now. Mm-hmm. I think that's often a very, very reasonable response.
And tend to my emotional attitude, spiritual outlook, and eating, and my body, and, mm-hmm. and we'll see what happens.
Right.
You know, there's you know, the serenity, this the Reinhold Niebuhr's serenity, or the abbreviation of the Serenity Prayer, and I'm going to get it wrong. God granted me the strength to change the things that I can or the courage to change the things I can change, the strength to accept the things I can't, mm-hmm. and the wisdom to know the difference.
Right.
And what the line that's missing from that, the sentiment, which is one you alluded to, is and the time that I need to discern.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in such a rush, so much wanting, that we don't give ourselves the time to discern.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes back to one of our earlier conversations. When you're just seeing what's in front of your face, you're slowing down this, taking a view of the bigger picture. Where is it all going to lead, or what does it all mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you get yourself some more time
mm-hmm.
to slowly look at what's in front of your face and then look at the bigger picture and then come back in.
Right.
And people who have that sense of pacing with themselves, if they can find it, will feel less desperate, less depressed, less anxious.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's true.
It's hard to slow people down.
It is, and when people are first diagnosed with cancer, they often want to take immediate action.
Right.
And with cancer, it's rarely a medical emergency. you know, usually you have time to explore your options, to think through. You know, there's some cases where you need to take immediate action, but they're the exception. But a lot of people feel overly pressed to get the cancer out of their body, like, tomorrow. And you don't really need to do that.
We're talking this morning with Bob Ritter, who's been a resident of Ithaca and Tompkins County for the past 19 years, and he's the longtime director of the Cancer Resource Center of the Fingers Lakes and a columnist. And we're just talking about some of the lessons that he's learned from cancer and who he is as a person. And one of the things that I want to switch to now, as we come down to our last 10 minutes, 8 minutes, what do you do for yourself? What practices or things do you do, little, minor, or big things, to restore your sense of balance or optimism or strength for dealing with life when life gets you gets you down?
I think the most important thing I do is sleep. I think sleep is really, really underrated.
Yeah.
And when I get stressed or cranky, it's almost always because I haven't slept enough.
I need 9 hours of sleep for me to feel like I'm fully restored, and that sounds like a lot to a lot of people.
It is, but people tend to dismiss sleep as being not so important.
Right.
And I need my sleep just like you. If I don't get it, you know, when I have a good night's sleep, I feel more optimistic. I obviously feel more energetic, and I see connections that I didn't see when I was tired. So sleep is critical. I have a wonderful beagle who's always causing trouble but is very sweet, and she came with the name Miss Holly Hunter, so it's a little bit odd to have a dog named Miss Holly Hunter, but that's her name. And but I like dogs because they relish that living in the moment. I remember walking with her, and there's a ray of sunlight on the sidewalk, and she like sat down and just gloried in that moment of sunshine. And that's, you know, living in the moment.
And it brings you, yes, to the moment, and then you can look up and see where it's coming from too. Yeah, cool. One of the things about a pet, like a dog that has an attitude, and it's some of it's positive and some of it's not so positive, is that it stretches you emotionally to live across a wider array of feelings where there's not a lot at stake. And one of the things that I think that I've read in terms of people coping well with life and aging in general, but is those who read scripture or texts that have a lot of stuff that's both very stark and very comforting and very painful and very horrifying, when you give yourself that kind of emotional workout, it keeps you alive and keeps you more able to kind of just stay with life. For my own practice with shared journeys, that's what I discover. The more profound inadvertent relationships people have, like with your dog or with each other, the more optimistic they remain, and the better they keep things in perspective.
That makes good sense.
Bob, is there anything else you'd like to share about what you do for restoration piece, in addition to the sleeping and anything about this, about the community, about singing activities? What was there anything you do? Food, diet, you know.
I love to walk. I love to eat. Ithaca is such a pretty place that sometimes just walking outside is just this restorative peace.
I've seen you walking out by the inlet channel.
I live along there.
That's what I was thinking. And that is a beautiful stretch. And it's also easy to walk
Very easy to walk and have lots of birds coming by and geese and ducks and deer coming to my bird feeders.
And 5 minutes from your office.
It's great.
Yeah. Well, Bob, will you play for us this last selection called Solo Flight? And do you want to say anything about it before we listen to it?
Sure. This Solo Flight is a piece done by Charlie Christian, who was one of the first jazz guitarists of note who played with the Benny Goodman Orchestra. And he really took the guitar from a rhythm instrument to become a solo instrument. So I love his playing. I also just love the the energy of the band. It's just a big band that really shouts.
Good. Okay. Let's strike it up. Charlie Christian with Benny Goodman and Solo Flight. And Charlie Christian introduced to jazz the instrument of the guitar as a solo instrument, I understand.
Yes.
And that is a powerful thing. I want to just make the connection here. We've been talking with Bob Ritter, who's with the Cancer Resource Center and a community asset, a person in this community. The Cancer Resource Center is in many ways a community or a congregation of persons who are invested in each other's care, respectful of each other's decisions, and profoundly seeking the good life that is possible in the face of cancer. And in that sense, we all are members of many different communities and congregations, and one of them may be a religious congregation. Bob has his flock in a certain sense, but there are also members of many other flocks. And one of the things that Bob and I have talked about is how can the ways we care for each other in our various spiritual and religious communities integrate more fully, particularly where there are people with cancer in congregations or communities, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever, and how can we be more conscious of the ways we support each other? And I think Bob can be an asset for helping us explore what that means, because we are members of many, many communities here.
Amen to that.
Bob, thank you for joining me this morning on the Made of Clay Report.
My pleasure.
And look forward to seeing these conversations unfold and these relationships. And we'll be hosting Tim Dean not long in the future, who's the head of spiritual care at Cayuga Medical Center, who also has a similar goal in terms of deepening our relationships with each other across our religious traditions.
Very much.
Take care. And this is the Made of Clay Report. This is WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.